At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah, a registered associate nutritionist and your favourite crazy bean. Full of Beans is on a mission to reduce eating disorder stigma and increase eating disorder awareness. Together, we will establish inspiring conversations with a range of individuals, including those with personal experience and their loved ones, as well as clinicians, researchers, and charities who are all working to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Using my personal battle with atypical anorexia and body dysmorphia, as well as my master's in eating disorders and clinical nutrition, we will together explore the experiences of like-minded individuals who are equally as passionate about sharing their stories to increase the understanding of eating disorders. Please note that this podcast discusses sensitive topics and should not be seen as a replacement for evidence-based therapy or treatment. Today I'm joined by George Mycock, the host of the Maya Minds podcast. Maya Minds' mission is to make sharing mainstream, providing exercisers and athletes with the support in sharing stories regarding their mental health. Often we think exercise is the antidote for mental health, but that's not always the case. As well as his brilliant podcast, George is also conducting research with Nottingham University to help support those struggling with mental health in sport. George has his own story to share, struggling with binge eating disorder and muscle-orientated disordered eating that we will discuss today. Hello, George!
Hello, what an introduction.
Oh, my word. Do you feel good? We'll do you feel your head getting bigger?
I do. We'll just wait a couple seconds for everyone to stop laughing at my last name. There we go. Right. Okay. Now we can go. Thank you so much for having me on. It is a pleasure. And it is today? Monday. It's 2 days before our podcast on the Maya Minds podcast comes out as well. So
exactly.
How exciting.
Having a little, like, we're chatting all the time at the moment, aren't we?
We are, actually. We are. It's nice. I've made a friend. I did it, Mum. I did it. it's been really nice. It's nice speaking to you, and you seem like a wonderful human. So,
oh, thank you. I do try.
Yeah, and that's all. I don't expect anything less from anyone who ever approaches me. You have to be wonderful. Otherwise, get out of my face.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us today. I'm really excited to have a chat with you. Like I said before, we have spoken quite a lot and I think we've got a lot in common. So I feel like our conversation today is going to be a very interesting one. Where I wanted to start with you today was to talk about your relationship with exercise and food. So, you know, we already mentioned in the introduction that you struggle with binge eating disorder and also muscle-orientated disordered eating. So if we could start, could we just explain to people what muscle-orientated disordered eating is? Because I don't think it's something a lot of people will have come across.
Yes, of course. This is not something I prepared in my notes, so here we go. So basically, muscularity-oriented disordered eating or muscle-oriented disordered eating is it's a form of disordered eating that is very under-researched. So really, no one really knows what it is properly yet because we haven't established that underpinning. But the general gist of it is that it's a form of disordered eating that is attempting to create a larger muscularity, whether that be in size, like mass, or also in leanness. And often the biggest issue within muscularity-oriented disordered eating, something that I experienced myself and in every other person I know who has similar symptoms, is that you have these contrasting goals of both wanting to be big and needing to eat more food in order to grow the size of your muscles and have that calorie surplus in order for that to be the case. But then at the same time, you want to be lean, so you need to eat less calories in order to like reduce the amount of body fat that you have. So it's this constant contrast of goals, and it's almost like a cyclical nature of being dissatisfied with your body. You're either big but you feel like you've got too much body fat, or you've lost some body fat but now you're small, And it's just constant kind of cyclical nature and makes things very difficult.
And do you want to just talk about how you've experienced that along with your other eating disorders?
My kind of journey with disordered eating is similar to, there's one case study on a guy who had a very similar story to me. And basically what for me, it started from when I broke my back when I was younger. And I gained a significant amount of weight. I broke it playing rugby. Rugby was my thing. And all of a sudden, I'm not allowed to play rugby anymore. I gained loads of weight. So I had this really like lack of self-worth in the fact that I've lost my thing. Like this was my one and only thing. And also now I'm hyper aware that I've gained a lot of weight because, you know, the doctor told me that I need to lose weight. The, you know, my surgeon and, you know, friends, no one really was like bullying me, but people obviously noticed. And I was, I was about 14, 15 when I went back to school. So you know, 15 year old people aren't going to be too kind of considerate about it. So it started with thinness orientated disordered eating, the more kind of in air quotes classic form of disordered eating, I suppose, in the goal of wanting to lose weight. And I did so very successfully. And I want to say it that way because that's how I was treated. In, you know, I was obese. I was, you know, according to my BMI, I was obese, and maybe even morbidly obese. So losing weight was a success, no matter how I did it. And I did it excessively. I, you know, lots of exercise and barely eating. And then somewhere along the way, I got to kind of this severely thin. I wasn't super low BMI, but I was thin. And then at some point, I started to connect with, and I'm still not really sure where it is, like what point, but some point I started to connect with wanting to be muscular and wanting to prove myself and prove my self-worth in being this muscular guy, this person who was like lean but also had muscle. I guess it came from, I started lifting weights whilst I was in my kind of doing my weight loss, and I started to kind of build some muscle just from like the kind of beginner gains, so to speak. And then I was known in the school as one of the, as kind of like the fitness guy, like one of the fitness guys. I was one of the bigger guys in school, and yeah, it became part of that. I kind of latched onto that as that's my new self-worth. Yeah, and then the issue with, and I wish I could be more concise with this and more clear, but it is just really difficult. The issue with disordered eating are these contrasting roles of wanting to get bigger but also wanting to stay lean. And that somehow to me resulted in this immense amount of shame around eating, what, you know, bad foods, again in air quotes. And that eventually attached onto this idea of like, when I do, I have to just binge them and eat as much as I possibly can. And then, you know, when I'm not, I'm severely restrictive and making sure that, you know, I'm eating clean, again air quotes, foods, and sticking to this like gym, these kind of classic gym foods, you know, chicken and rice, broccoli, that kind of stuff. And it's just, yeah, this kind of contrast, this like general contrast, and exercise plays a huge role in muscle dysmorphia and this muscularity oriented disordered eating, in the way that, you know, obviously kind of similar to the way that in, you know, the classic way of exercise addiction in someone who's more thinness orientated, they feel that they need to exercise in order to burn off the food they ate or in order to maintain their like thin physique. Muscularity oriented people feel like they need to lift weights, so they need to do some kind of weightlifting or resistance exercise in order to maintain muscle or in order to build muscle. So I have to excessively exercise, otherwise I'm going to lose the muscle that I have. And in the same way, sometimes, you know, doing cardio and doing stuff like that, I would still be, you know, I need to do this, these weights, I need to do them to this excessive amount in order to maintain my muscle, and then go and do cardio so that I can also burn fat at the same time, which isn't, you know, scientifically maybe actually what's going on, but you kind of, that's kind of how it plays in your mind. So yeah, that is the roundabout explanation of how it is. And yeah, I apologize, it's not very concise, it's just it is kind of, it's a muddle.
Well, I think you don't have to apologize for it not being concise, because I think a lot of the time things like this, perfectionism is a pretty strong driver, and people often want like that perfect story or that perfect recovery or whatever, but it just doesn't exist. One thing I wanted to ask you from what you were saying, because I think I resonate quite a lot with you in terms of
you were speaking about like your identity. And I think definitely at uni, for me, I became like the power lifter, the girl with abs sorts of thing. And for me, that was a very difficult thing to let go of. So have you tried to sort of change your identity so that you're not maybe that big guy?
Yeah, yeah. And it's something, you know, one of the reasons why, one of the kind of main instigators around Myo Minds and why I set up Myo Minds was to, I used to always talk about these definitions of ourselves, how we would define. And I think it's something that's really common in the gym and athlete community. We all know that guy or that woman who is the gym. That's what they you know, identify as. And I think a lot of people fall into that, and especially athletes as well. If you know, if your coach is telling you you need to do this, you need to do that, and you get all this praise for being successful in your sport, it's very easy to narrow your vision into, this is my thing, this is what I'm good at, this is all I'm going to be. And actually, in the gym community, the word like obsession, being obsessed with it, there's a guy called CT Fletcher who I don't want to call out because he was like one of my biggest inspirations in the entire world, especially in the gym, and I still a fantastic person, but he always talks about the fact that you have to be obsessed if you want to be like this. You want to be a bodybuilder, you want to be massive, you want to be the biggest guy in the room, you have to be obsessed with it. And it's in that way, basically addiction becomes this glorified kind of this holy grail of an individual. If you can be the addict in the gym, if you can be the one that gets there at 5 a.m. and trains for 3 hours, or, you know, whatever, if you can be that person that does that, that's like the golden standard. Like you can put your self-worth into being that, into being, it's glorified, basically. It can become a problem, and that's where I was, you know, if anyone questioned what I was doing, they didn't get it. Like I'm obsessed, I'm that guy, like I'm the one. And my friends who used to train with me even now make jokes about the fact that, you know, I was on the phone with my friend only a couple of days ago, and he was saying how, you know, remember when we used to do, I remember we'd be training in a three, and whilst when I'd finish my set on the bench, and then I'd be spotting for one guy, and then when the other guy came on, I couldn't wait for one more person to finish before I did my set. So I'd go and do a superset or something else, and they'd always be like, George, where are you going? What are you doing? We need you. Are you going to be up next?
Yeah.
But I was just, you know, I glorified that, and you know what really was going on was all these issues and this kind of shame of, if I don't do it, then I'm not that guy, and so who am I, like what's the point?
I think it's interesting, and like this is something that I've always questioned, because like you said, some people do get to the gym at 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, they're there, they've got the protein shake, they eat very clean. Where do we begin to draw the line of when that's a problem and when it's not? Because is it just the fact that that's possibly how we both were, and we recognised it was an issue, and we're kind of saying, actually, I don't know whether I want to be that kind of like compulsive about exercise. And then, so I'm going to change that, and I'm going to be kind of different, have a better relationship with exercise. And then the other person just hasn't really recognised it's even a problem, and they're happy. Like, I always question, how do we begin to say that person's okay doing that? Because to me, it looks exactly the same as the way, you know, we both were with exercise as well.
Yeah, and it's something that I often, get questioned about. But I think people tend to presume that I hate exercise, and I think that no one should exercise, which isn't the case at all. I exercise often, and I still love it. I still love doing it. I think there's, when somebody is exercising excessively, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a psychological issue. There's exercise addiction that's primary exercise addiction, so you're doing it just purely based off of wanting to do exercise. And then there's secondary exercise addiction, which is usually when it's attached to an eating disorder or some form of disordered eating. And then that they people who are secondary tend to have the psychological issues more than people who have the primary. But even still, if you are just a person who loves doing exercise and does loads of exercise, you can still get some physiological issues, like, you know, REDS, relative energy deficiency in sport, which can lead to all sorts of physiological and psychological issues. But I think in regards to exercise addiction, you know, that person who's getting going at 5 a.m., how can you tell, you know, if there's two people going at 5 a.m., how can you tell if one person's got exercise addiction and one person doesn't? I think one thing that's really important to look out for, or you possibly an identifier, could be the use of a negative feedback loop compared to a positive feedback loop. So a positive one is probably the safer or like less issue option, although it can be either way. But the positive one would be, when I go to the gym, my anxiety seems to go down, or when I go to the gym, my body looks different. That feels great. I want to do it more. Mm-hmm. And that kind of loop. Whereas the negative one is, I go to the gym and my anxiety goes down, or my body changes. If I don't keep going to the gym, that's going to reverse, or something bad's going to happen. Mm-hmm. So now I need to go. Otherwise, there's an issue. And I think it's kind of a subtle switch, but from want to need seems to be the bridge there, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a really good distinction to make, because I think you're right in that wanting to go to the gym, it sounds so similar to needing to go to the gym, but it's so different. But I guess, I don't know whether you know you'll have the answers, but how would people start to determine I want to or I need to, because it is such a close thing. And, you know, I'm just speaking anecdotally here, but you know, before I exercise, I feel a bit anxious. I feel like I need to get it done. And once I've done it, I feel amazing. So that, you know, could be that positive loop that you're talking about, in that you're feeling good when you come out of the gym, blah, blah, blah. But it's that initial bit beforehand that's like, you need to do this. Yeah. So how do you even start to pick those thoughts apart?
Yeah, and it is really difficult. And I think it would be impossible for me to do that over a podcast, because it's kind of funny, but it is also legitimate that, you know, everything that we say on our podcast is very much for the general, you know, I suppose in research, the thing that we're actually saying is that in general this is happening, or, you know, in general, but there are always outliers, everyone's different, blah, 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 blah. We all know that those terms, but I think it is very difficult, and part of the issue at first is actually being able to articulate it, or at least to understand how to understand, which you know, things like these kind of conversations, and, you know, picking up on things like the need, and picking up on the possible guilt. Guilt is a really high correlator with compulsive exercise, which is very similar to exercise addiction. I won't bore you with the differences, but
I'd quite like to hear the differences, actually.
Oh, okay. They use the term exercise addiction now. There's a guy called Mike Trott, who I really hope I got his first name right there. but he's kind of come out recently with some like good meta-analyses and stuff, and they in his meta-analysis he defines that we should use exercise addiction because that encompasses both compulsion and dependency. So compulsion is that kind of linked to, similar to like OCD, in the way that it's that kind of need. It's not a case of I want to do it. It's done despite injury, not lack of enjoyment, etc. You have to do it. That's the compulsion. Yeah. And dependency is, if I don't do it, then bad things happen to me. So you get like withdrawal symptoms, etc. Mm-hmm. And that's, so exercise addiction is both of them together. That's the difference.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the difference between compulsive exercise and exercise addiction. And as I was saying, guilt is a really high correlator with compulsive exercise, which is it's encompassed in exercise addiction. So I'll basically use the two terms as one, but it's, you know what I mean? And having guilt around exercise can be something that you can start to notice. So if you don't exercise as much as you wanted to or planned to, do you feel guilt about it? And is that guilt kind of significant? Does it have a significant impact on you? Like, does it actually kind of ruin your mood? Does it have an issue with does it break down your day? Does it make it worse? That can be something that people can point out, or kind of can highlight there might be an issue there. And also the fear of guilt. So you might not actually be experiencing that guilt because you are doing your exercise, but are you afraid that you're going to feel guilty if you don't do it? Is that like, I'm not a psychologist, but you know, when you were just saying there with your example, if you're, before you do the exercise, you're thinking, if that anxiety that you have is based around, if I don't do this well enough, then I'm going to feel crappy, or this has to be the standard, otherwise there's an issue. That can be something. And I think for me, it was always a comparison. So I have to do more than the person with me, or right. the person, especially if I was training with someone. And even to this day, I train with my friends and stuff, and I'll enjoy it more now because I focus on the enjoyment of exercise more than it being goal orientated. But I still my subconscious still wants to train by myself, because then I don't have to compare to the fact that my mate did, you know, a few extra reps. Like normally it would be, okay, I have to do another set. And then if they do another set, then I'll just do another one. And then I would just keep going. And there were even times where I would like sneak off. I would say I'd go into the toilet or something. And then I would like go into the other room and do a set on that machine if no one was on it, just so I can, in my head, I was like, I've done more than them. So I'm doing fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, really, because I think obviously exercise can be part of an eating disorder, but it also could be distinct from it with the exercise addiction. But it's interesting that you talk about the comparison there, because I think that's also such a strong trait that is present in eating disorders as well. So it's, you know, very clear that there is such consistency between the two of them.
Yeah, definitely. I always say, I think people often get kind of taken back when I say that I'm a narcissist, because narcissism has such a negative, like you laughed there yourself, and narcissism has such a negative connotation with it, that it's someone who's like really cocky and full of themselves. But you know, the definition of narcissism, I hope I'm getting this right, but is basically someone who is, you know, their self is the kind of important, or the image that they're portraying is very important to them, and in that is other people's perceptions of you. So if, you know, you're anxious about what other people think you look like in the gym, or look like in your clothing, or whatever, that is narcissism. And I think that's the reason why muscle dysmorphia, narcissism is one of the classic traits of someone who has muscle dysmorphia. And people think, oh yeah, because they're all just cocky like gym people. Like, but no, it's actually usually because they're incredibly anxious about what other people think they look like. So I am a narcissist, but you know, I wouldn't say I'm cocky, but I am concerned with what other people think of me and how I portray myself.
I think it's really good that you raised that, actually, because I think we do need to change our mindset a bit about the way that maybe we see other people in the gym. Because I won't lie, you know, when there's, you know, a guy in the mirror like pumping his biceps, or you know, taking a picture or whatever, my first instinct will think, God, he loves himself. But then, you know, if I took a step back and I thought, actually, like, you know, you check yourself out in the mirror a lot, and that's not because you're thinking, damn girl, you look good. It's the complete opposite. So I think, like you said, there are a lot of stigmas associated with it, and I think because it's not spoken about that much, those stigmas, you know, we're trying to raise awareness of different eating disorders and the stigmas associated with that, but I think this is like a completely new kettle of fish that maybe people haven't even thought about yet.
Yeah, we're also terrified of being arrogant, that the even talking about what might be arrogance is scary, because what if we accidentally find out we are arrogant? I think that's where it is. But there's a difference between confidence and arrogance, and I think confidence is believing in yourself and thinking you have self-worth, and arrogance is making sure, like telling yourself that you're better than the other person, which isn't the case. So yeah, I think that's where that fear of talking about checking yourself out in the mirror is, because it is a narcissistic thing to do, is to capture an image of yourself. But really, I don't want to make a blanket statement on everyone. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who do it purely because they enjoy it or whatever. But really, you're taking that photo because then you're going to send it to somebody else to get their perception of it, or you're putting it on social media to create a perception of yourself in some kind of way. Yeah, maybe next time you see a guy flexing his arm in the mirror or woman, you know, think twice.
But on the topic of that, not necessarily I'm going to go up to a stranger in the gym, because that could potentially be slightly weird. Mm-hmm. But if somebody listening, you know, maybe not even themselves, but have noticed maybe a family member or a friend that is becoming more preoccupied with the mirror and maybe making comments about the way that they look, what sort of things do you recommend that people do to kind of keep an eye or just make sure that their family or friend is doing okay?
I'm going to say the two things you shouldn't do first. Mm-hmm. Don't be avoidant. Don't think, oh, someone else will deal with it. Because odds are, if you're listening to this podcast, you're the person who's more interested in this kind of stuff and more likely to be helping somebody else. So you're that person, I'm afraid. You're the person that everyone else has said, or someone else will deal with it. So it's you, I'm afraid. And two, this one's really important. And again, it's a thing that people don't want to talk about, but don't be confrontational. Because mm-hmm. especially if you try and reach out in some kind of like vague way or subtle way that you probably should do, it can be frustrating. And as someone who has an eating disorder, I'm certain I have annoyed people who have tried to help me in the past, and quite rightly so, because it is frustrating to try and help someone who doesn't want to be helped. Mm-hmm. Or even doesn't recognize that there's an issue, which is probably the case in a lot of people when it's exercise involved, because exercise is the wonderful, amazing thing that only does good, which, you know, isn't necessarily the case. When you're going up to someone, try your best to recognize if you're a bit annoyed or if you're frustrated, and don't outrightly say to them, I think you have an issue, or I think you have a problem, or like, I think you have an eating disorder, or I think you have exercise addiction. I think saying those words just immediately puts people's guards up, and I think it's not usually the way to go. I think there are exceptions there, so please don't take it as literal. I think, you know, for example, if someone said to me, George, I think your exercise addiction is coming back, I'm probably self-aware enough and accepting that I have the issue there enough to be able to say, oh yeah, actually you're probably right, and I'd probably take it okay. But I think in most cases it's not right. So I think the thing to do is to be supportive, and to open up the chance for them to be able to say something. So I think not necessarily telling them that you're going to be, you know, that you think is an issue, but saying, you know, if they recognize as an issue, or they think, you know, say, oh yeah, I listened to this podcast the other day about exercise addiction and stuff, and yeah, I think it's probably more common, and you know, even say, you know, I recognize some of it in myself. And you know, and again, immediately you've kind of opened up that conversation of like, that's a thing that can be, that can happen. And then you can, you know, just start with comments of like, you know, the classic, like, how are you? But how are you really? Like, you know, you're asking again. And you're just creating that environment where someone can be like, oh yeah, actually I'm feeling a bit crap at the moment. I want some help with this, or you know, I feel like this. And then once someone opens up, then you can maybe start to question a bit more if they're okay with that. You can say, oh, is it, you know, I did notice actually that you're exercising quite a lot and stuff, you know, is that tied in with it? And they might say no, in which case, you know, don't be confrontational, don't chase them down. allow them to figure it out. But yeah, just giving them the opportunity to say it themselves.
Yeah. Another question that I have, and sorry that I'm bombarding you with questions, but no, I mean, the questions are coming to my head, so maybe they're coming to people that are listening. But something that I've always muddled through is, if you had an addiction to something that not everybody has in their life, mm-hmm. I'm in no way saying that it would be easy in the slightest, but obviously the way that you get over the addiction is to cut it out, and you know, it's gone, and you know, you might be in situations where it comes up, but the way of treating it is, I guess, more obvious. And even with an eating disorder, again, not saying that it's easy in the slightest, but if somebody's struggling with something like anorexia, often the treatment is, you know, firstly is to start incorporating more food. But with exercise, it's difficult because, you know, even going for a walk, that is exercise, and you kind of have to do that in your day-to-day life. And like we've said before, not all the time, but exercise can be something that's really good. So if you are struggling with an exercise addiction, you know, is it the case that you just need to go ahead, cut the ties, don't do it for however long you need to in order to kind of introduce it back in and see where you feel comfortable? Or is it something that you can kind of carry on doing, see how you feel, manage maybe the, you know, start working on some psychological therapy? Or what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, and again, I'm not a clinical psychologist or anything, so I can't say for certain. But I think with all these things, it depends. And I think for myself, it was the case of slowly making steps towards changing the way that I felt about my exercise, rather than necessarily. Well, I suppose it did incorporate changing actually what exercise I was doing, but it's more about that feeling around it, because the same with eating disorders, it's not, you know, although maybe in some cases people are just told they have to eat more, even made to eat more, because they're in a state where they might die or there might be some kind of serious implication. Mostly the treatment is, why do you feel that you have to do this? Like, why is that the case? And it, you know, it's a psychological disorder, not a physical one. And it's the same with exercise addiction. It's not physical, it's psychological, and it's trying to figure out what is underpinning it. And you know, in some cases it might be that they need to stop altogether, you know, especially if it's a secondary exercise addiction and it's alongside kind of anorexia or, you know, severe restriction of food, then there's going to be some dangerous outcomes if someone does continue to exercise in that excessive manner, so they may need to immediately stop. But yeah, I think it's a really difficult question to answer, because I don't want to tell anyone that this is the way to do it. But my personal experience, it was, you know, even just starting as small as like, I'm going to swap out the exercise that I hate doing. Like, because I feel there's this saying in exercise, which is a load of crap, and it's like, oh, people, I hear people say it, okay, not all the time, but occasionally, where it's like, oh, if you hate doing that exercise, then obviously that's the one that you should be doing, because your body's telling you that you're not very good at it, and then you've got to do it. And I used to live by that, and that is such a load of, like, I don't want to swear, but it's a load of crap. Like, it's literally, so it's a load of poo, it's a load of doo-doo. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. No. It's a thing that personal trainers or not, I'm not crapping on personal trainers, a lot of wonderful personal trainers out there, but you know, it's a load of people who work in a gym or something have just said it because they couldn't be asked to change. Sorry, might have been a swear, I don't know. Couldn't be bothered to change the exercise in their group class. So they just said, oh, well, you know, you don't like it because your body's telling you that you're not very good at it, so you got to do it. It's not true. Like, if you hate an exercise, if it really just, like, you feel horrendous when you're thinking about doing it, don't do it. Which is easier said than done. But yeah, so for me, like, you know, just stopping doing the exercise that I hated doing and putting an exercise that I actually just enjoy doing, and then starting to be like, I'm doing this because I like doing it. This is fun, not because I have to do it. And, you know, stuff like that. And that makes it sound like it was a really easy road. And like, I just stopped thinking that way. But it did take a long time, and I messed up a lot of times. But that's kind of my general way I went.
No, I think that's really good. And can I just say, I completely agree with you with not doing things that you hate. I hate dumbbell curls with, like, passion. I hate them so much. And my, like, coach still puts them on my program. And every week I'm like, how many times have I said this? I'm not going to do them. But also, thank you for highlighting about the psychological kind of aspect behind both eating disorders and exercise compulsion, because I think it could be very easy to presume that you do just need to get rid of the thing, or, you know, work with the thing that you're struggling with. And I think often people say, I'm talking about eating disorders here, so let's, like, transfer it to exercise, but people often say eating disorders aren't about food. Well, it might not be that the like food is the actual issue, but you're using the food as a mechanism to cope. And I guess it's the same with exercise, isn't it? It might not be the actual exercise that is the issue, because exercise can be really good, but if you're using exercise to cope with a situation, that is when the issue arises.
Yeah, and I think the big problem that comes in is that some, like for example, I'm going to use the eating disorder example, because I think it's more clean in the way I can explain this. But, you know, if someone is severely thin or you've lost a severe amount of weight, and the way to initially fix that, the way to stop them having these physiological issues and the heart failure or whatever's happening from the severe weight reduction, is they need to eat more food.
Yeah.
So then people think, oh, so that's how you fix it, because that's how you solved that initial problem. But that's mm-hmm. just like one of, that's just the initial problem.
Yeah.
That it doesn't mean that that's all the problems are. That's the only, it's like static issue. There are, you know, it's the classic one that people talk about is the iceberg model, of the idea that, you know, the food and the exercise is the tip of the iceberg. I don't know why I'm making the signal to you. No one can see this one.
I'm getting an explanation.
Yeah. the tip of the iceberg is sticking out of the water, and that's, you know, you need to eat more and you need to exercise less or whatever. And sure, we can address that if it's an issue immediately, but the actual iceberg underneath, that huge mass of ice underneath the ocean that's keeping it, that's making that thing stick out, is trauma, I don't know, adverse childhood experiences in the past, or the, you know, all these psychological issues, bullying, social media, all these stresses and stuff that are pushing those things to the surface. But we all just have that zoning in on, oh, it's about, they're just not eating enough, they need to eat more. And it's not the case.
Yeah. No, definitely. And then something else that I wanted to discuss with you was the social and the psychological effects of compulsive exercise. I think we've kind of already touched on psychological a bit, but I think a lot of the time exercise is seen as this really amazing thing that has no negative consequences. So if we could just, you know, discuss a little bit about maybe the negative consequences that can happen if things sort of do get to that point where they're, you know, addictive or compulsive.
Yeah. So I suppose I'll start with social stuff that can be the case. And two main ones are kind of relationships and like occupational issues. So, you know, the relationships first, you know, you're less likely to go to a family gathering or a friend's gathering or parties, etc., nights out, etc., because it's going to influence your, you know, the goal that you're trying to get, which is this like body manipulation, trying to look a certain way, etc., or it's going to hinder your exercise because, you know, I didn't go on nights out, or at least I didn't drink, and I'd come home early all I would talk about is exercise, and, you know, it becomes so much of you that, you know, no wonder you're the perception from other people is all this guy or woman or, you know, all this people person talks about is exercise. They never want to do anything fun, they never want to blah blah blah, so why would they want to be friends with you, like you know, it's very difficult to become friends with people who aren't within the gym, and then you know the friendships that are within the gym tend to be quite shallow because all you'll want to talk about is exercise and stuff. So, you know, it becomes really difficult to maintain friendships, so you start losing friends, and then, you know, you're already got a poor self-worth that you're trying to prop up with this lifestyle, but now also, you know, even though you're doing it, you're exercising more and you're eating less or whatever, now if people aren't being as nice to you or aren't as friendly with you, aren't trying to keep in touch outside of the gym, so then you think, oh, you know, and maybe if your coping mechanism is exercise and eating, then you think, oh, I need to do that even more then, because then it'll, you know, then it'll maybe make people like me more because my body will look different or whatever. But sometimes that can sound almost like ridiculous if people listening to me saying, oh yeah, people will like me more if my body looks better. But I think, at least from my personal perception, I don't know about you, but that's how I felt, like, you know, maybe not consciously, but subconsciously, if my abs look a little bit better, then that person's going to like me more, respect me more.
Yeah. I'll have more friends if I look a certain way. That's definitely what my thought process was.
Exactly. And then occupationally, basically the same thing, you know, I worked at B&M, which is like a big chain shop, whilst I was like doing my undergrad. I used to, at summers, I would come home and I used to go to the toilet to do press ups and then come back. So obviously my boss or whoever would say, like, you go to the bathroom to, like, you go in the bathroom like loads, like, yeah. What, like, thinking I was just trying to, like, take time off, or, you know, or you were in the bathroom for ages. Little did they know, sorry, that's my dog barking. Little did they know I was doing a workout in the bathroom for like 20 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever, like a quick workout. Yeah, so luckily I never did get fired or anything, but you can see how that can lead to losses and issues with like occupational stuff. So yeah, it has an effect on your entire existence, your entire life socially, and then obviously psychologically, the impact that in a kind of a physiological manner, you know, especially if you're exercising a lot and not eating enough, your blood glucose is going to be low, and glucose is one of the things that can pass the blood-brain barrier, so your brain's not getting as much energy as normal. So then you're gonna, you know, your functioning's not gonna be as optimal as it would, and that can end up leading to depression and anxiety, etc., etc. But also, you know, I think, again, this is going to be a thing that makes it sound like I hate exercise, but I don't at all. But the culture around exercise basically just breeds like issues. It's so like, when you break it down, it is so horrendous. You know, I've written down a couple examples here. So one of them is that the idea of working hard and like no days off, you know, you have to push yourself. Every workout has to be like pushing yourself, and you can't have like a relaxed workout because then you're just wasting your time. And if you have a day off, then, you know, you're just lazy, you could have done something. That's building guilt, and we spoke about guilt earlier. It's one of the biggest kind of correlating factors. It's literally just breeding guilt. Then the second one is the classic stick to the plan, or, you know, my plan is best. You know, a lot of personal trainers, coaches, etc., make these like cookie cutter workouts, like the same thing, and they just send it out to everyone and say like, oh, just do this, like this is like optimal, this is the best way. And, you know, if that person goes off it, they say, oh, like, you know, you need to stick on it because, like, you know, that's a bad thing, you've gone off it, you need to stick on it. You know, exercise and nutrition are so individual, like ridiculously individual. If you take, like, let's say like a football player, there might be, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, who's arguably one of the best players ever, very like physically impressive. You know, if you did his exact nutrition and training plan, it wouldn't work because it's all he does. It's all that, like, it's his life. Is his nutrition and training plan is designed around him, his behaviors, the way that he thinks about food, the way that he, what food he likes, the way he likes to train, that blah, blah, blah. So even if you copied like the arguably the best player ever or whatever you want to say, it wouldn't work for you. Like, it wouldn't, because you're not him. But we tell people that if you don't stick to this thing, then you're bad and you're wrong. But no, you're just it's just because you're not the same human as this thing was designed for. Finally is the focus on body shape and size. Like weight and shape concern is something, again, that's really commonly found in disordered eating and in exercise addiction. And, you know, when was the last time you heard about someone going to the gym because that wasn't because they wanted to look different or wanted to lose weight or wanted to whatever? And when was the last time you got complimented in the gym for something other than the way that your body looked? And it's hard. Like, I'm so aware of it, but I still sometimes, if I walk into a gym and I see my mate doing bicep curls, I'm throwing it up almost, like, oh, your arms look great, or like, it's just because it's so like inbuilt into the way you're supposed to talk. But it's just telling people, like, the reason I like you is because your body part looks good when you're doing this thing. Don't do that. You know, and it is really hard, but it's, again, it's just making people think that the reason you like them is because they look good, and you shouldn't do that.
It's difficult though, isn't it? It's difficult in normal life. You know, I am anxious about coming out of lockdown and people seeing me for the first time, maybe in a year. And naturally, people's first thing they will look at you and they'll probably have a comment about how you look. And so in normal life, it's, you know, you look well, which I would take as you've put on weight. But in the gym, like, that is an environment, like, that's an aesthetic environment. So you go to the gym, like, people are going to comment on something or other, because like you said, for the majority of people, that's why they're going, is to kind of change the way they look.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess I don't really have an answer for it. I suppose, like, you know, it's not, I was going to say especially, but it's not especially hard, but it's kind of differently hard for people who are actually trying to be, get bigger and trying to be more muscular, is because, oh, you look like you've lost weight, or you look thin, or something, is a classic compliment. It's like the safe thing to say. But to me, that is, oh, you look like you've lost muscle. Like, which, that's all it says to me. And you know, it's just, I suppose it's just building up that barrier of like, this is just they've just said that because it's just what they think is a thing. I have these other things that are great about me other than the way my body looks. But I'm the same as you. I definitely have anxiety about how people are going to comment on my body when I come out of lockdown, because I've definitely gained weight, and haven't been working out anywhere near as much as I would, because I don't enjoy home workouts as much as I do gym workouts. And it's, yeah, I suppose it's just part of the reality. But I think, you know, I know this isn't what you're saying, but I think some people would say, oh, you know, so why bother even talking about it? Why bring it up? I think, you know, it's, don't ignore, like, just because the problem seems to be inbuilt in society and would be very difficult to change, doesn't mean we just shouldn't talk about it.
No.
There are several movements that we can mention there. And, you know, there are things that are inbuilt into society that we all take for granted, and all, you know, people just assume things, and people just say whatever. And we need to, you know, there needs to be changes. And so I think it's the same with the exercise culture, or the way that we perceive exercise, and the, you know, the gym culture itself needs to change.
Yeah. And I mean, this is just my advice. Whether people, this was quite ballsy of me, whether people have the balls to do this, it's completely your choice. But when I did see someone after lockdown one, they did say something about my body. And my head instantly took that as a negative. And I was like, oh God, you know, this is a catastrophe. But I stopped myself and I just said to them, what did you mean by that? No, oh, sorry, that sounded really rude.
You grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and went, what did you mean?
I very nicely, in my lovely voice, said, what did you mean by that? Not quite like that either, but I can't do it now without sounding aggressive. And then they did reply, and it was completely the opposite to what I had thought. So if you do have the confidence, I guess, to say to somebody like, oh, would you mind? And even if it's after the event, like send them a message or whatever, I promise you it will definitely not be what your head has assumed. So it is, yeah, if you can, I would recommend that you do that.
And I also think that like 99.9% of people, and I think the 0.1% who say that they haven't, actually just don't realize it. But I think everybody has had some kind of weight and shape concern at some point in their life, or someone said something and it's made them think. So I think if you do send a message, you'll say, oh, like that made me feel like, you know, when you said this earlier, I know it probably didn't mean anything, but can you just clarify what you meant? Because it's kind of messing, it's playing on my mind. I don't think anyone would ever have an issue with that. And if they do, they're a loser.
So, get rid of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that conversation, George, I had such a nice time. I think, I mean, I was asking you questions for my own personal benefit, to be honest, but hopefully everybody else has taken something away from that as well. So just to wrap up, the kind of last question I've been asking everybody is, if somebody is listening and, you know, they resonate with what you're saying, what would be your top tip or best advice for them to kind of leave? I guess we'll stick with the kind of compulsive exercise here, leave that behind and have the confidence to do so.
I think this is probably an answer you're going to get from a lot of people, so I apologize up front, but I think the fact that you'll get it from a lot of people means that it's important, is that you should try and speak to someone about it. And being with that, I have a tip for speaking to someone about it, which I think is really important and often miss, or not thought about, is tell that person beforehand, because it's scary. Well, we've all been there when someone says they want to talk to you about something, sometimes it's scary because you don't know what you're going to say or what to say. Mm-hmm. Say to them, what I'm about to tell you, I'm quite scared to tell you, and just so you know, I don't want you to fix it or to say anything that's gonna to like, you know, make me feel better. You can even just reply with a nod or an okay or whatever you want. Please don't think you have to say anything, but I need to tell you something. Is that okay? And that, like, it's not weird. It just, if anything, it takes the pressure off that person. They can immediately be like, oh, okay, I don't need to fix them or come up with something. So yeah, that's what I would say is speak to someone and clarify with that person what their role is in the conversation before you start, because that can make it easier for both sides.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much. And I would just like to say I'm so glad that Millie did bark, because she made an appearance in the podcast, which made me very happy.
She has like a knack for knowing when I'm recording and deciding to bark. thank you so much, Hannah, for having me on, honestly. It's awesome to be a part of this podcast, so yeah, thank you.
I really hope that you got as much out of that podcast episode as I did from George. For me, this episode summed up what this podcast is about, and that is providing you with resources, education, understanding in a simplified manner of why whatever eating disorder you're going through, why that's happening. For me, like I said in the podcast, compulsive exercise is something I still struggle with, but talking to George has given me insight on what I need to do to make changes. And so I really hope that maybe it's this episode, maybe it was another one, but I do hope that you can go away and take something from it, and that it really enables you, your recovery, your loved one's recovery, your patient's recovery, just to be supported that a little bit more by having that understanding. Next week, we've got another educational podcast from Charlie Babb, who is a PhD student, and she's looking into the link between anorexia nervosa and autism. The conversation was really interesting because so many traits in autism are apparent in anorexia, but because of starvation, and a lot of autistic women don't get the right support because it's just not adequate to manage their autism and their anorexia. So the work that Charlie's doing is invaluable.
If we take the example of a restricted or a rigid thinking style, this is something they kind of possess anyway because of their autism, and in a way that might play into the development of the eating disorder, you know, thinking about having a rigid routine around food and things like that. And then we know that kind of the body is in this state of semi-starvation, that they're going to have more rigid thinking patterns anyway. It just kind of reinforces itself, I guess.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe to be one of the first to hear it. Please also like, comment and share this podcast with anyone you feel that may need support at the moment. Not only those struggling with eating disorders, but also their loved ones, as this can be a very difficult time for everyone. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, and this podcast aims to motivate and inspire individuals along their path of recovery. If you are struggling with an eating disorder, charities like Beat, Seed and First Steps have great resources. Please also reach out to your local GP to see how you can gain support for your eating disorder. See you next time. Bye!